Welcome to Vacation Station, hosted by Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazines.com.
Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Vacation Station Travel Show with Nancy and Lisa. Well, you know, every fourth Tuesday is dedicated to the Fire Monkey. I have to say that because I even email her the Fire Monkey. Fire Monkey is a travel writer, Debbie Stone. And I always have to say why we call her the Fire Monkey. She got the name when she was in Bhutan. And you know what? She is a little fire monkey. She just bebops around the countryside. And now she's going back around the world through Europe. So we're really excited to have her back on the show before she takes off and to talk about her adventures in Arizona, in the Phoenix area in specific. She went to three main destinations, and we're going to be talking about that today. Her articles are all up on blendradioandtv.com, as well as nationalparktraveling.com. In fact, her next segment is all about the Channel Islands in California. But welcome back, Debbie. How are you? Oh, my God.
I called you Debbie. You got Who's that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know any Debbie's. No, I know. It's like we should just put you on the expert page, on your expert page on the website. So I'm just going to go Fire Monkey. She's not Debbie. She's a Fire Monkey. But listen, you are in Arizona. So, you know, that's got a little warmth to it, you know. So that's
pretty
cool.
Yes. Yeah. It was gorgeous weather. It was beautiful weather when we were there. Just beautiful.
Nice.
You know, springtime in Arizona is really lovely.
That's beautiful.
I know people are sending photos of saguaros in bloom right now. And I'm like, I'm feeling just a little homesick. You know, the doves get out there and the bats at night go swinging from them. You know, it's like
hummingbirds.
Oh. And then the night blooming Sirius happens at night. Oh, my gosh. So,
that's a really nice time to visit Arizona. I think in my opinion, you know.
Well, you're in Santa Fe, so it's not that far for you to go.
And we did it as part of a trip where we drove over, did a bunch of that, and then went over to see some of those California sites in Channel Islands, which you talked about. So we did kind of a combination trip, but it was nice to get, you know, also in the Palm Desert area. It was just nice to get some nice, warm, sunny weather, you know.
Oh, and you went California in spring. It was beautiful with all the poppies. Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
And, well, you being in Santa Fe, like, Georgia O'Keeffe, we just heard, we have the New Mexico Bed and Breakfast Association that comes on our shows every month now. And in Santa Fe was well represented. And they were talking about Georgia O'Keeffe is getting, because I know you docented there. I don't know if you, are you still docenting? I mean, because
are
you ever home?
Yeah, that's the thing. I had to kind of let that go, but also then the pandemic did away with the docents. So, and then I know that they now have audio tours and things like that. As far as I know, I don't think the docent program is back up and running, you know. So, but, I spent a number of years there and, felt really good about my time there. That was something I really wanted to do. And, this is O'Keeffe country.
But I was wondering, because, you know, she's all flower art, but I heard that they're, like, doing an addition to her museum.
Well, they're doing a brand new museum.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of like just a half a block away and in this area. So it's going to be a bigger museum. And I don't think they've done anything yet. I think they've just done like plans and all that kind of stuff, you know. It should be something. Should be really something. They've been looking for some expansion for a while, you know.
And she does have all those, you know, the flower art. But, you know, it's like flowers, you know, what I remember the most is, well, I was amazed at all the cityscapes she did, right? But she, you know, that's something we never think of. Everyone thinks about the flowers.
Right.
Yeah. But there were like flowers and bones. So she kind of always, to me, represented rebirth, you know, because of, you know, skulls and flowers. Mm. Yeah. And it's like when we think about spring travel, Arizona is beautiful in spring. I love the summer because of the monsoons like you get in Santa Fe. I really love summers in Arizona. I'm weird. I like to hike at 4 in the morning and watch the sun come out. And if monsoon season comes, you get the moisture and the sky. And it's magic. So I really, Arizona is a year-round season, you know, depending on what you like or don't
like. What you like to do.
Yeah, but you you went to some places that Nancy kept saying, oh, we got to go, we got to go. And like now we're not in Arizona. So yeah, smack on the wrist. One of them is the World of Music you talk about is the Musical Instrument Museum. We went to the one in Carlsbad, California. And
there's also UCLA has one.
Yeah, it's within neat.
This
one, I think they're kind of related in some way. I'm not sure, but this... Hmm. I've been wanting to go forever because a lot of the musicians we interview perform there, like Pierre Bensusan, Akana. I mean, I've got a list who they go and perform, and they kept going, it's just up the road. We should go, timing wise.
Yeah. But, you know, it's one of those things. I think a lot of people who go to the Scottsdale Phoenix area don't, first of all, maybe they've heard of it, but some people have never heard of it because maybe their focus is the resort scene or, you know, that kind of thing, and they're there for the warm weather. But I had been hearing about this museum for years, and one of my husband's sisters lives in Scottsdale, and she was telling me about it, and she's like, oh, my gosh. She goes, you have to go the next time you come. And so I was like, okay, we're going, and I was like, now I need to go, you know? So and it was better than I'd ever even imagined. I mean, she had, you know, she told me it was wonderful and incredible, and she couldn't stop raving about it. And when I went there, yes, I could understand why she was raving so much.
Mm. Well, it's neat because, you know, the photos and everything show in your article, and everyone, this is up on blendradioandtv.com right now. And you can also go to the website. I encourage you to go to their website. It's mim.org for Museum of... Musical Instrument Museum. I want to say museum. It's Musical Instruments Museum. So mim.org. I just love this. I don't think you would get me out of, I think I would be there for a day and
yeah, have
a
for problem. Sure.
But they, you know, just this whole regional history of music, because it gets really cultural. You know how Nancy and I are about that. But, you know, when we look at, instruments today of what, you know, rock and roll, you think about how did a guitar get, you know, sounded, and you know, the history of oboes, and half of our music comes from the Middle East and the islands, you know, it's really interesting. Did you find when you were there looking at all these regional exhibits that some of the instruments were, this kind of freaks me out, like in a good way, that people in general were creating instruments in their geographical region, right, their locale, but we were all making the same kind of instrument, maybe just not the same amount of strings, or, you know, just with what we had, that it seems that we were doing the same thing.
Yeah, I think in all parts of the world, people were finding whatever they could that was available to them in terms of materials or whatever to create music, you know, other than, you know, using their bodies to create music, and their hands and their feet and all that. But then, you know, to find instruments, it was like, okay, find something that you can maybe strum with. And so, you know, find something you can blow into, you know, it was, or something you can pound on, you know. And so I think that there was this commonality in terms of maybe that kind of, those kinds of genres about the different types of instruments, and people would use whatever they had available to do those particular, you know, make those kinds of sounds and noises and explore, you know, the way you make music. And, you know, the whole purpose there, I think, is also an overriding purpose of bringing, you know, bringing people together. You know, music is something that unites people.
Oh, and for sure.
So global, and everywhere you go, you get exposed to music and of different kinds, and it's fascinating, you know, and people really love it. It's something that puts smiles on people's faces.
Well, I think we copy a lot of it from nature. So you've got birds singing, so then people are like, well, I could do that. And then you think about, okay, drums, well, I can beat on something, and maybe footsteps as you're walking creates
and
kind of
hands,
a thud,
hands clapping, thud, you
hands
know? Yeah.
clapping.
It's our heartbeat. It's
yeah,
our heartbeat.
It's a rhythm. It's a rhythm. The waltz is always kind of odd because it's off, you know, by that one beat, because we don't walk like waltzing.
Not unless you're Matilda.
Yeah, or you're watching Lawrence Welk, you know.
No, that now I could, no, let me, anyway.
But I think, you know, when you're there, it's, and like you said, you can spend a day there. You could spend days there, and people, you know, that would want to come back and see more, because, you know, it just depends on how in depth you want to be. I mean, I felt like, oh my, and I had, you know, several hours, but I felt like I needed so much more time, because at every little place that you go to, every little country that you that is on there, and let me tell you, there's the collection is, you know, thousands and thousands. They have more than 13,000 instruments in their collection, and over 6,000 of those are on display at one time.
Wow.
And they're from every, you know, seven world regions: Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Latin America, Europe, and the United States, Canada. And so you see the instruments, some of them very rare examples, and you also see the costumes, which are fascinating, and then you also see these videos where you can, and you get these, you know, you get the audio device so that you can plug in and you can listen to whatever video clip you'd like to hear and see at the same time. So you're seeing the people that are, you know, that in that region, you know, making that music with those instruments, and it's wonderful. It's such a great sensory thing, because it's the seeing, it's the hearing, you know, it's all of that. And it's just, you know, to me, you know, and you see people and they're just like mesmerized by certain, you know, certain video clips that they're hearing. And then they're looking to the side and they're looking at the costumes and then they're looking at the instruments that are in front of them. And it's just this wonderful immersive experience.
I would want to play one. I want to touch. I'm going to be one of those people that they're like, hey, don't touch that. But I want to play them.
Well, you can make music there in their you know, area where you can, in the experience gallery, you can go and be a musician, and you can try out some of these really interesting, you know, like the Javanese gamelan, or you know, the harp from Peru, you know. And so you see all these people and they're really into it, and it's like, when would you be given that opportunity?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Oh. See, I like that, because
I want to go.
Yeah. The touchy part, because
play.
I think it also, it's the inner child in us, right? It's the inner child in us. But I think for kids and families, this is, you know, and I think museums, and, you know, we've talked about this on shows with you, like when you were in Springfield, Illinois, and you went into the, I think it was a library for Abraham Lincoln, one of the museums or library you could hear the voices of what people were saying about Lincoln and his wife, and, you know, and the drama of it all. And I think museums, because it got to this point of museums being stodgy and boring, and kids just go, I'm going to look at a bunch of dusty old stuff. And for kids, this wasn't an exciting thing. But museums have really pushed the envelope where it's super exciting for kids and families. And it seems like this one, it would be a good starting place for a family just starting to get their kids out on an adventure together, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because this is a real all age experience. And we, you know, I saw families and young kids, I saw older people, and everybody was enjoying it at whatever level they were at, you know?
I love it. I want to go, and I'm sorry, but I'm jealous. You know, there's a few times I keep emailing you back. You know, I'm jealous.
Yeah.
I know that is not a good personal quality, and I know I will get to places, you know, everything's yet, I will get there and I'll be there. You know, yet is, I will at some point, but it's like, dude, when it's the musicals, like you went to Cleveland, you did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know.
Cool. Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Have you been to the Experience in Seattle yet?
Oh, several times. I was there when it opened years ago.
Dude.
Yeah. It's a fabulous place, because it's really, it's wonderful, a place for Pacific Northwest musical, the roots of certain genres.
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix, exactly.
And Nirvana.
Yep.
Oh my God.
I mean, all these Eddie Vedder, you know, all Pearl Jam, you know, all that.
Yeah.
You know?
Dude.
And, you know, it goes through the whole, the grunge cycle, you know, that whole thing. Yeah. And so, you know, so wherever you are, you know, the music scene is so interesting and unique. And so, you know, if you get the opportunity when you travel to experience music, whether you go into a pub in Ireland and there is Irish music going on, you know what I mean?
Cool.
It's like, just do it, because it's such a wonderful way to immerse yourself in and get a real good feel for the culture.
Yeah, I really agree.
Yeah, and I don't understand when people like, I only like this kind of music. I'm like, no, man, You can't be like that. You got to go listen to it all. And maybe the first time you listen to something, you're like, okay, not my cup of tea. But then again, you listen to it again, you start to hear. You know what I mean? Like you start to
absolutely.
Really,
yeah, you do. You get to. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I mean, of course, we all have our different tastes in music or what we prefer or what we like. But it's so nice to be exposed to different music, you know, and, and whether, you know, whether you end up being an opera buff or not is not not the point. The point is understanding, you know, when you go to an opera, it's a story. There's a story going on, you know, and it's done in such an incredibly dramatic manner, you know, you can appreciate that. And I think that the word appreciate is important because you may be able to appreciate something, but it may not be your cup of tea, but that's okay.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Especially when it comes to the arts.
Yeah. The arts are, you know, what unite people.
Magical.
I mean, music, you know, people can hear music, not understand the words, and they
but
unite.
You still like
and it's
it.
Medicine. I mean, all the interviews we've probably done in the last COVID thing, and just wait for everyone with our new Celebrate the Arts magazine. It's going to be like, we might as well write
huge.
A book with all the musician interviews that what happened over
wonderful.
COVID. And they were talking about like being able to do live streams. It's not the same as being in front of the public, but everybody, it was like not having vitamin D. I'm just saying.
I know.
We're talking about
Arizona.
It makes me happy. Vitamin D and it's being outside. It's the same thing as music, not seeing a live performance. Not having that, but music united people in ways during COVID. All the new music these musicians created, now they're on tour. It's like this emotional thing. And every musician we've been interviewing, it's just like, dude, it's medicine, period.
Yes.
And I think it is. And it's a universal language. I know that's a cliche, but it's true.
But it is.
It is.
Well,
okay. Yeah. I want to go. Now, this was in Arizona and Phoenix. Now, I know you were born and raised in Chicago. Hey, the Chicago Blues, right? Let me just say Chicago. And Chicago also has this whole other music history that is mind-blowing. But I'm going to say Chicago Blues, you can't beat it. Our friend used to run a club with James Cotton in Chicago.
Yeah.
And the stories that come from that. In fact,
there's
a documentary coming out. There are some stories that I don't even know if we're allowed to tell, they're good. They are so good. But anyway, a documentary is coming out on him soon. But so, all right. So Wrigley, you know, the Wrigley name is a big deal in Chicago, but here the Wrigleys are in Arizona and you went to the Wrigley Mansion and this whole story is mind blowing. In that what he built in the desert, right? It just doesn't, it's kind of like Scotty's castle in Death Valley in a way.
It's
like this big mansion and then like, you're having this fancy meal and we need to talk about that. There's a little spam involved, but then there's the, I need to talk about the pineapple, the crazy pineapple, which I know the Victorian la-di-da thing, but, at this point, here's this big mansion that, you know, he built for his family and they were going to tear it down. Like what heck?
I know.
And this
Isn't
was in the 20s. Was this in the 20s? No, not the, when did they want to tear it down? It was built in the 20s.
It was made back in the 20s. It was going to be, I think
it was
1992. Yeah.
Yeah.
The city was planning to tear it. They were going to tear it down and build condos on the site. When the Gordy Hormel of the Hormel fame and his wife purchased it and they restored it and they added to it and they made it an incredible event space and a wonderful restaurant and a place that people could walk around and see a slice of history that is pretty cool. And, you know, like coming from Chicago, the Wrigley Building in Chicago is quite well known, and everybody in Chicago knows it, and everybody knows who Wrigley was. But I was unaware of the fact that he had, you know, I probably assumed that he had other houses, but I didn't know that one of them was right there in Arizona. And it's quite the estate. And Gordy, you know, and his wife really put a lot into it, and it, you know, they could, you could see it was a labor of love in that respect. But you know, Wrigley, you know, he was a tycoon, but a self-made man, and you know, he came out there to Arizona because of the Arizona Biltmore Hotel. And yeah. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, he decided to give his wife, his wife Ada, a very nice gift, this mansion for their 50th wedding anniversary.
Okay.
And they called it La Colina Solana, which meant mm-hmm. Sunny Hill, but it was their winter cottage because they only spent, you know, maybe up to 2 months a year there because of getting out of Chicago, of course. And but, you know, the place is huge. I mean, it was, I think it finished in the 1930-31, and, mm-hmm. you know, 17,850 square feet, 24 Jeez. Different rooms, 17 bathrooms. I couldn't believe that.
Wow. I mean, how many people lived there?
It wasn't, you know, that there. What the funny thing is there wasn't many. I mean, the family, yeah. you know, the kids, and then, wow. you know, staff, and then it's like, you know, it wow. was, it's mind-boggling. And it was built then for a cost of $250,000 at that
gosh.
Time, which is,
you know,
about
really.
$3.5 million now. But, you know, it probably would yeah. be even more. It's just, it is
crazy.
Really amazing. But you were talking
yeah.
about, they have, like, when they would have guests about the pineapple, which I thought was really pretty funny, you know, and it was like this, I love this thing about the pineapple, because they would have this pineapple, it was a decorative pineapple, and on the railing going up to the upper rotunda of the main area, and there was this pineapple had this crown on both the top and the bottom, and if the guests stayed at a time, longer maybe when they might supposedly should be staying, the crown of the pineapple, you know, they would be, first it would be right side up, but if they overstayed their welcome, it would be flipped upside
oh.
down.
Bye-bye.
See, well, I remember Jay Leno always said, like, you know, after 3 days, you
yeah.
start cooking the fish.
Yeah,
that's
because
right.
that, yeah.
You get the fish, you know. But
actually,
this where they start
said
smelling
the guests
like
start smelling like fish.
Yeah, well, maybe because you start cooking it. But the pineapple thing is funny because, you know, when we talked about when we were in Erie, Pennsylvania, we went to the, don't ask me the mansion name, but it's the Hagen History Center, the William Kutze.
Oh, on Prophet Street.
It's
Wealthy
on the,
Street in the corner of Wealthy
Millionaire,
and Prophet
Millionaire Street. It was Millionaire Street.
Yeah.
And this guy didn't really, he's the one who created asbestos. And he did not care really about the design other than he was showing off. So pineapples went everywhere, all this Romanesque stuff. Meantime, down the street is all the industrial area with bricks and brick making. And they were making waffle iron, cast iron, all of this stuff. But here he is. I'm like, you know, the man who made all of this. And so he just, it was, they really wanted to show off at that point. It was,
right.
You've got to think about these, you know, multimillionaires from back then, Carnegie, all of them going, we're self-made people. And look at us. We're,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're badasses.
You know,
look at what we did.
I have to say the pineapple thing, the
right.
pineapple is a sign of good luck. And it
right.
has been for a long, long time, especially in New England. And there used to be, I think I remember, oh gosh, we're going to go back in school here. There were laws about you couldn't sell or possess pineapples because they were a good luck charm.
Not
right.
just good luck. It's about having the money to purchase exotic fruit back in the day. Like in Erie, Pennsylvania, we talked about that. They
right.
were saying that having pineapples were a sign of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is part of it, because you couldn't just get pineapples in the middle of
right.
the Midwest in winter.
You
know,
no.
Thank you, railroads.
So
Hawaii
should be fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So if you were able to get them, you were rich. You were affluent
right.
would be the word.
Right.
So
right.
I find this really fascinating about him. I mean, these are, you know, self-made affluent people, and they wanted to show off. They had pride, but I think it was in some way, I want to say that they were also trying to inspire people that you can follow
right.
and do things, you know?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. But I, yeah, there, you know, they're, and the house itself is, you know, it's got some wonderful original items, you know. One of the most interesting ones, though, I love is that Douay Art Player piano. This was made for him. He, you know, spent, I think it was $10,000 to have it made by two different companies. And it's interesting, the story when we heard this, that he approached these two different companies and he asked about making this unique instrument, and they both turned him down. And so in response, he sent them a blank check. And so obviously the rest is history, because the piano is one of only two in the world. The other is owned by the Smithsonian. So it's pretty cool. And when we were there, a gentleman was playing it, which was kind of neat to see. And and then, you know, just the other really unique thing is that switchboard room, which I thought was fascinating. And it's like, so they never had an operator. So nobody answered their private phone calls except for the family. And William made sure that everybody knew how to use the technology. And so the walls and ceiling are lined with foil gum wrappers, because that reminds William of his, you know, of the Wrigley gum and his humble beginning, so to speak. It's also because foil at that time was thought to increase receptivity of the Switchboard Museum. So that was really, really cool to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's really interesting too, because when you start talking about the receiving thing, organs, when we used to teach music and musical organs, like in the store, if you had an old Wurlitzer and things, you could hear police calls and sirens.
It was so cool. Yeah.
The organ, which to me, it's like, dude, that is such a trip. It's so cool.
Fun.
But okay, so we went back to music again.
Yes.
Right? But let's talk about, is it Jordy or Jordy? Yeah, Jordy Hormel.
I think it's, Gordy,
you know, G-E-O-R-D-I-E, everyone. Jordy. And I hear the word Geordie, I just think of England and accents I can't understand. Yeah, but this is really amazing. His musical legacy is pretty darn huge. I mean, that's amazing.
I didn't know anything, you know, other than the fact that he was the, you know, one of the heirs to the Hormel Meat Company. I did not know that he was, you know, a gifted musician himself. He was a composer. They said he taught himself how to play the piano at the age of 5 by listening to songs on the radio. And then he is credited with composing a lot of the theme music for television shows like Lassie and Gunsmoke and The Fugitive. And then he had his own recording studio, and he worked with, you know, the Stones and Fleetwood Mac and John Lennon.
Cool.
And, you know, so he was in his own right, you know, extremely successful and a very talented individual.
Awesome. That's interesting too about him doing that with Fleetwood Mac, because Stevie Nicks comes from Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's kind of interesting.
That's right. I remembered that she was.
Yeah, and so he worked with John Lennon, and you got to think of her song, one of the most iconic songs, "White Winged Dove." Just like a white winged dove, she wrote that when John Lennon was murdered.
Oh, and my gosh.
It was like, just like a white winged dove. That was part of her, you know, just that was that is like, you know, American Pie, like the day the music died when, I mean, and he was writing about, you know, Don McLean was writing more about Big Bopper and everyone and, you know, of those guys. Right. But this
all the guides in the plane.
Yeah. Yes, but this one, you know, John Lennon, when he got murdered, I think we were living in England when it happened. And I remember as a kid, I was a fan of his music as a little child. Like, he was a hero. And I was like, how could someone do that over, you know?
That was crazy. I remember the headline saying he was shot by a fan of his music. I'm like, well, geez, thanks a lot, dude.
Well, he was a very, put it this way, he was probably a very deranged individual. You know?
Really sad. Yeah. But, I mean, this is interesting about the music. And then going in and you can have, you know, cocktails and brunch, a really good brunch with beautiful views. But your brunch sounds like you got cake and dessert,
it was brunch. I didn't need to eat any more food the rest of the day. Put it this way.
And then you got to go, you know, and so this is a major wedding venue too, which I think is
big deal. They do tons and tons and tons of weddings and receptions and special events, and it's just one of those places that, you know, you get this beautiful view and you feel like you're in this very special place, and you know, the staff there is extremely accommodating and very pleasant, and so yeah, it's just a wonderful place to go, and let you just go and have a drink if you want to, and then you know they do offer tours to the public, and you know, so it really is a great experience. And you know, people, if you live in the Phoenix Scottsdale area and you haven't been, go up there and go to the bar, have a drink. You don't have to go and have a meal if you don't want to, you know, and go have a tour, you know.
Yes, yeah, so go have a tour and be all like, have a cocktail and be all like, this is mine, all mine at once.
Yes, mine.
It's part of my family. It. No, but I love this, you know, and I think there's something interesting about how, you know, and going back to Georgia O'Keeffe, right? How people flocked into the desert Southwest. And we normally hear actually mostly about New Mexico, right? Or Southern Arizona. So it's interesting to hear more of the Phoenix side of the arts coming through, art and architecture. And Frank Lloyd Wright brings us back to, okay, you were on the show, was it last year or this year? I can't keep up. Talking about the historic Dana Thomas House in Springfield, where, you know, this, you know, very affluent lady had, you know, inheritance and, you know, said, here, build this. But she had a voice and he's like, no, you're going to do it my way. And then he gave her a room and then he just messed with it. But this is really interesting. Well, Frank Lloyd Wright, I mean, he's iconic. He works with nature, within nature. And, you know, when we were in Madison, Wisconsin, we were on the Frank Lloyd Wright trail. And I'm like, stop snowing. I want to go see what's going on. But and then Pennsylvania. So now I'm like, oh, because I got into the whole thing. But I didn't know about Frank Lloyd Wright in Phoenix. I had no idea.
Yeah,
like, this one was a new one for me. Yeah. And I think it's interesting because obviously you've just been to another one of Frank Lloyd, and you've been to others, right? So this is okay. So you're getting that thing where you're going in different places, but here's that web of connectivity. You know,
absolutely. You know, I was being born and raised in Chicago. Frank Lloyd Wright had a huge influence, especially in Oak Park and in the Midwest itself. And so I grew up, you know, knowing about Frank Lloyd Wright. And I remember my parents taking me to some of those houses in the Midwest and, you know, being very, very interested in learning all about, you know, his style and the prairie homes and you know, incorporating nature and, you know, all those elements that he's so well known. But I didn't know anything about this place until a couple of years ago, that Taliesin West, which is the name of his studio and his winter retreat, that, you know, he went out there and, like, you know, Wrigley and like so many, you know, he was really taken with the desert and decided that he wanted to create this retreat and this, you know, studio and, you know, a place for him and for his wife and for also the Taliesin Fellowship, the apprentices that came out from the Midwest, and they helped build it. And it, you know, it became this real desert laboratory where they could try out and explore all these innovations and designs, and where he would train the next generation of architects in this way, a way in which they wouldn't just be sitting there designing, but it's a way that they would come to understand by actually building, you know, by doing it. And so they used, you know, their hands, they were building it and understanding how the design isn't just on paper, you know, how does it become an actuality, you know? So I thought that was really, really interesting. And it is a beautiful gem. It really is. And when I saw it, it was even more beautiful in the fact that Dale Chihuly, a noted Pacific Northwest artist and a glass artist at that, had several collection of installations there. And it was like the incorporation of his work with Frank Lloyd Wright's place and the nature and being in the desert was exquisite, just exquisite.
Go ahead, Nancy. Now, I was just going to say that when you're in a place like that, we found with our travels coming back from the east side, coming back to the west, how just as you move from place to place, the sky seems to get bigger.
Oh, yeah.
You know, definitely. So I can see how that would make a difference to an architect, for sure. Well,
and Dale Chihuly, too, because he's going. I mean, that's what's so interesting, you know, right now as we record this, and even when this airs, we're still in the Pacific Northwest. And, right. you know, to me, that it's very interesting out here how people use color. Some people are just like, no, I'm stuck in drab. And then there's homes like on the coast and the ports, the harbor areas, where people are just like, look at me. I'm having a bright orange house. Check this out.
With a green not, you know, door.
And I'm right. not going to have mold or right. moss grow on stuff. I am like, we're going to have this. Yeah. And it stands out like flower power. It's like, it made yeah. me feel more like we were in Mexico, actually, in mm-hmm. some places.
That's interesting.
yeah, yeah. Right. It's like, hello, here we are. Color. And so it's very interesting going around neighborhoods. And it's, you know, England did it. And even in South Africa, we had those little colorful houses on the beaches where right. the beaches could get yes. that gloomy look. And yes. and so yes. and then the gardens, I mean, we could have these really overcast rainy days, as you know, we're learning about Pacific Northwest, but the colors pop in the gardens, through all the people that do tulips and daffodils and lilacs and cherry blossom yes. trees, all of that, when it pops, it's like, yeah, okay, so this is, you know, it's about, and so I think when I look at Dale Chihuly, and I know you just came back from his garden, right? His glass garden in
yes,
Seattle.
Yes, his garden and glass in Seattle.
Garden glass, yeah.
Yes.
When I was looking at the photos of that, I was, because just being here in the Pacific Northwest, mm. I'm like, he's one of those that use color to open up what is a closed sky versus the desert. So I find this really fascinating about you seeing his work in both completely places. Day and night.
Yes,
terrains, landscapes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it's amazing how his work. But you know, there's so many commonalities between these two men, and you know, even though they grew up in very different environments, they both nature was important to both of them, and mm-hmm. I think their mothers were both very instrumental in instilling a love of and a respect of nature. And encouraging, you know, creativity and expression and for both men. And so it's interesting how that the fact that they grew up in such different places, but yet also just what tied them together, you know, and how this landscape, how Chihuly's work fits so seamlessly into this landscape that it just, you know, you think to yourself, wow, you know, he really understands the environment here, and it, you know, all of his installations are just they're beautiful. They the mm. colors, they evoke the landscape, the desert, mm-hmm. the shapes look like desert plants. You know, I mean, it's just mm-hmm. it's amazing. And I've heard, I did not do it at night, but I've heard at night it's just exquisite too.
Oh, I want to do that, and I want to cool. tell people, you know, if you're. This exhibit is on until June 19th, 2022. However, I mean, you can still go to the Taliesin West, right? And go and tour
yes.
the house after
absolutely.
That. And, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. But I wanted to go back on this because it's going back to Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture. And, you know, Tucson is, you know, interesting because there's like the old neighborhoods. There's some areas that have the Barrio District style mm-hmm. And right. is the Barrio District and the Turquoise Trail. And I know you know Tucson really well, too. And but there's this whole era, and it kind of is the Frank Lloyd Wright era. I know he's good at yes. the prairie houses, and I know I'm familiar with those now, but they're where they are these low yes. rider houses. They're low riders. but you're kind of, because the more you build up, the hotter it gets. So it yes. kind of, you're almost like the rocks in the landscape of the yes. desert. Like you're part of the boulders and the rocks.
Yes.
And you
yes.
allow the mountains to be the magnificent.
The mountains. Yeah.
And you
yes.
have the open sky. So he really, looking at your pictures from this, he really understood. I mean, that's just, it's so night and day. I mean, you heard us when we were in Madison, Wisconsin, going, holy cow, there's snow. But I understand why you want. Like, I understand now, but right. I mean, for him to go from that to that, he yeah. really had to, I wonder if he just sat out there in nature for a day
Probably.
Or two to feel the elements, mm-hmm. to understand yeah. what you need to do.
Yeah, you do wonder, you know, I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. I think though that, you know, both men are just, you know, very hyper aware of their surroundings and of the natural world. And so, you know, the creative juices stems from, you know, that inspiration. They're so inspired by their environments. And, you know, when I was there, I marveled at how they really just, they got it right, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
We had an employee that worked for us for a while, and she had never seen the ocean. And we took her to the ocean. And she was just so blown away. She had her hand over her mouth for 2 days, just walking back and forth, stopping and staring at the ocean. Because if you have never, and so when you go from a very wooded, Rocky Mountain kind of thing, and then you go to the coast, that's a huge difference. It's a huge difference, but, you know, because if we have the wherewithal to travel more than people, you know, before us, we kind of get used to it. We also have TV, and we have people who are painting pictures and showing us, hey, it looks like this. You know, but if you've really never seen, like when the first time we saw Mount Rainier, we're like, holy crap.
Dude, seriously, when we were staying in Bonnie Lake up here, so now there's this road going to all these housing complexes, and the couple we were pet sitting for, they're like, you know, they are born and raised in Seattle. And she goes, this was the sticks out there when they were growing up. This was like, she never in her life thought she would end up living there. However, it's one of the most TikToked views of Mount Rainier is outside their door. Like, you catch it, you go around, because everything's, you know, circles here. You know, what do you got, roundabouts. And I'm like, oh my God, the one day I drove and it was there. I've hiked the park. I mean, we've done a ton of hikes, but it's kind of different being
down there.
I don't know if it's up. Yeah. And there's a high school, I think it's called Mountain View High School or something. And when you, I mean, they have the view. I was like, dude, that would be cool to go to school there just for that.
But I wouldn't study.
It is interesting how these designers really take in their surroundings. I would like to read his notes. Do they have anything there showing Frank Lloyd Wright's, like, sketching, or is that all personal?
Yes, in his office there, you know, they show some of the sketches. They also show some of the projects that he and the apprentices were working on in the drafting room, the drafting studio, you know, so they do show you some of that. There's also, you know, books that are available you can look through, you know, so you can get good ideas of kind of what he was working on. And, you know, he was working on projects all over the world, you know, so and I think it's, was a unique experience for those who were his apprentices, you know, to have that opportunity. And, you know, he's probably the biggest name in American architecture, you know? Around the world, you know? So it's quite a wonderful experience. I encourage people once again, just like the other two entities that we talked about, the Museum of Musical Instrument Museum and the Wrigley Estate. You know, if you go to Arizona and you do have the time, you know, when you're not, you know, if you're swimming or playing tennis or playing golf, that's great. But, you know, if you have time to go check something out, these places are right there, you know. Everything
And great
right
for
there.
Summertime. Honestly, during the summer, you want to go in, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a good time to do it. And I want to give everyone, go to franklloydwright.org for that website, and you'll find the Taliesin West on their site, and also wrigleymansion.com. Go there. And then mim.org. Yep. And Debbie's articles, just type in, I'm going to start putting Fire Monkey on a keyboard.
Oh, no.
All your articles. Just type in Debbie. You could just do Debbie. It's all good. Just put in Debbie Stone and Arizona. These articles will come up right on blendradioandtv.com. It's just amazing. And what I also want to just close with is that people think the desert is just one big swath of sand and a few Gumby cactus. Really shows. You know, if this is your first time going to the, you know, Arizona in the desert, shows this whole other side that folks may not realize existed. And it's all about light and the play on light and music and
color.
What happens
and color.
Yeah. Mm, I love it. And music. And music. So everybody, Debbie will be back next month. You know, as I always say, every fourth Tuesday, she's on the show here on Big Blend Radio. Next week, next month, excuse me, is the Channel Islands. From there, it's Washington State again, right? Wenatchee.
Yep.
Wenatchee.
Yep. Yep. And we have to keep. We have to keep it lively. You know. So.
Yeah.
I know. She just wants to. You know. She always does stories with something I can't pronounce. But you, I think you're the one who taught us how to say Wenatchee, because I was like, it's Wenatchee. No.
Wenatchee.
Okay. All right. So we're going to be hearing about that.
I want to say Wenatchee.
I know Wenatchee. I know. It sounds like some dramatic movie. Wenatchee.
Yeah, I know.
Everything was really nice and quiet until
Wenatchee
went to Wenatchee. All right. Well, thank you so much, Debbie. Everyone, again, keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Thank you so much and happy travels.
Yes, and to you too, ladies. Thank you again. Take care.
You take too.
Care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.